Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Now, greatly daring and trembling, I'm going to stick out my neck right away in this study and say as sweetly and as simply and like a little child that I am going to assume all the way through that I'm reading, certainly in the first two chapters, that I'm reading the work of King Solomon. I'm not trying to commit any of you to that view. If you think, or people you have read or heard think differently, but I'm quietly and naively going to stick to it. Indeed, I go further than that. I found in my notes dated 1960, which was hardly yesterday, a summary of the three books which go under the name of the wisdom books in the Old Testament, part of this hagiographa, the holy books that I was mentioning. I have this note. The Song, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes, and the note reads like this, and in this order: the Song from Solomon's youth, mystical application concerning Christ and his church. Proverbs from Solomon's middle age, the emphasis being ethical and moral. Ecclesiastes from Solomon's old age, emphasis upon what is natural, stressing the limitations of earthly life. Now, I have no idea in the world where that came from or who said it, or whether it was just myself that said it, and I don't think so. There it is. I'm not putting any stress upon it, but there is what I found in my ancient notes. The one from his youth, and the other from his middle age, and the last from his old age. Now, I find this last, the book of Ecclesiastes, about the limitations of life under the sun, exceedingly intriguing, not least since a fortnight ago, in our morning study in Revelation 21, I spoke a good deal about the new earth, to the surprise of some indeed, and I dealt with that to some extent last Sunday evening in Kirkcaldy Temple Hall Church as well. The new earth. And I spoke about the correspondence which I supposed there would be between our sinful mortal bodies and our resurrection bodies. I mean, they're both bodies, real bodies, as Jesus proved in his resurrection. And also a correspondence between the old fallen earth and the new reconstituted, resurrected earth, which is to be. Now, that sought to tie the two realms, the natural and the eternal, as firmly together as possible. Whereas in this book of Ecclesiastes, the emphasis is on the limits of life within a fallen world situation. So, what is the theme of this strange book, which so many find a puzzle and a perplexity, especially to be within the canon of the Old Testament Holy Scriptures, and indeed amongst the hagiographa, the holy writings? Some have thought that it is a worldly book, thoroughly earthbound, and of course, that is largely true. But it gives a view of our earthbound life, offered surely by a believer who may have lived so long as a carnal and materialistic creature, as believers can do, that he is able naively to castigate that way of life and show how hopeless it is. I refer you to a short paragraph which Derek Kidner includes in his commentary in Ecclesiastes by G.S. Henry. G.S. Henry used to be a Church of Scotland minister in Stirling, but he's been teaching in America for many, many years, and he has a paragraph here about the book and about the preacher or the teacher. Koheleth is the name. And this is what G.S. Henry says. Koheleth writes from concealed premises. This is his estimate of the book of Ecclesiastes. He writes from concealed premises, and his book is in reality a major work of apologetic. Its apparent worldliness is dictated. Its apparent worldliness is dictated by its aim. The preacher is addressing the general public, whose view is bounded by the horizons of this world. He meets them on their own ground and proceeds to convict them of its inherent vanity. And Henry goes on, this is further borne out by his characteristic expression, under the sun, by which he describes what the New Testament calls the world. His book is in fact a critique of secularism and of secularized religion. Now, there is no doubt that here and there throughout the book there is clear evidence of the writer's belief in God, as we shall see perhaps before the end of this study in the second chapter, verses 24 to 26. But the writer largely sticks to the view of life, and here is the characteristic phrase which sums up the theme, the view of life under the sun. So the book is a study of life under the sun, with the top, the heavenly top, the heavenly godly top, lopped off. And there is a sense in which the writer is saying to us almost right away, go on, live for the things of time and sense, and give yourself thoroughly to them, as no man on earth ever did like Solomon. And by the way, you only need to read 2 Chronicles chapters 1 to 9, or more briefly, 2 Chronicles chapters 8 and 9, to see how thoroughly Solomon entered into all that he could in this life. And so it seems that he's saying, go on, live for the things of time and sense, and give yourself thoroughly to them, and see how you like it. I happened to switch on some television news in a hurry this evening, and found in one of the channels that Malcolm Muggeridge was being challenged by three journalists about his life, and they were trying to get him to express his pleasure in his earlier carnal, sinful life, which he admits very freely. But they couldn't get him to do it. He said he'd no pleasure in it at all. See how you like it, says the writer, and see if you do not come to the same conclusion as I have come to, says the great man. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now you see, that is a very different point of view from that of our study in Revelation 21, which saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, as simply the heavenly and spiritual idealization of all that is best and wonderful in this wonderful old earth, with its infinitely fascinating wonders. Its wonders discovered, and its wonders as yet undiscovered. And we know that one of the great things about being in Christ is that a new tension is created within the spiritually intelligent mind. on the one hand, of becoming even more intrigued by this old world in which we live, and on the other, of yet being wondrously detached from it all, as a world which we know is due one day for complete demolition and reconstitution when Christ comes. So that we find Christians amongst those who are most engaged in research into such as geology and the chemical and physical composition of the earth and of the other celestial bodies as well, doing so because they realize that God made them and they want to explore his creation, while at the same time, as Christians, they are undoubtedly far more interested in Jesus himself, who made all these things, than on the things he made as the giver, you see, of every good and perfect gift, the giver before his gifts. And that's a true godly and Christian attitude, isn't it? And many notable and famous scientists who are Christians have held that point of view and sought to explore and understand and discover as much as they could about this old earth, because it's God's earth, fallen as it is. Now, it is this tension or polarity between the two which I think is at the source, indeed, may I say this, is at the source of the enjoyment one finds in life in a fallen creation. You remember Paul's exciting reference to the natural world, Romans chapter 8, verses 18 to 23, his reference to the natural world being subject to futility, a futility not of its own will or wish. That's very exciting. The fallen creation, subject to futility because of God's ultimate purposes. And this is true of even some of the most deprived of one's fellows, that they inquire into various realms of human experience, and even when greatly handicapped, find wonderful satisfactions in life, like blind people or cripples or people with other handicaps, who, because they have found their hope in God. We often think of Jesse Webster, our disseminated sclerosis friend, who a year or two ago gave a series of talks on Grampian Television to say how much God meant to her in her incapacity. They have found their hope in God far above the sun, and have sought to make the best of this old world and discover so many wonders in it. I was reading an article the other day by a blind person, the son of a Salvation Army officer who has stayed in my sister's home in Aberdeen, Richard Rance, speaking of his wide interests in life, a blind man. And I remember his father telling us about him when we had lunch one Sunday many years ago. And the recurring motif of this article from the Salvation Army's musical magazine is blind? Who says I'm blind? Listen to this. His first paragraph: it may seem strange to many that I regard my blindness as being God's special gift to me. That takes some courage to say that, doesn't it? I regard my blindness as being God's special gift to me, yet it is no doubt one of the facts of my spiritual life that my lack of sight has opened up avenues of service and witness, as well as channels of personal spiritual development, which may well be less easy for a sighted person to harness. I'm looking at Myrtle Stephen as I end that quotation. I'm sure that's meaning much to her, because her life is spent working with the blind. Now, don't you think that's wonderful? So that, you see, it is infinitely sad to read the testimony of one of the greatest men who ever lived, if it was actually written by Solomon, pouring out this discovery he made, that all is vanity. And there must have been a time or times when, because of all the natural advantages God gave the writer, he gave himself up entirely to a this worldly view of life, and sought exclusively to make the best of it all, and so devoted himself to the exploitation of all that was enjoyable in this life, every pursuit, every pleasure, and every advantage, so that thoughts of God were utterly excluded from his mind. He could never have written as he has done otherwise, could he? And it's surely this, you see, that misleads people and puts them off the scent of what the book means in the economy of divine providence under the aegis of the Holy Spirit, what this book means in the canon of the Old Testament. Read the verses and see, these verses that we're going to look at in a moment, read them and see that, as someone has put it, even the most salubrious experience in human life leaves a God-shaped blank. That was John Lee's expression, my colleague in a student for the ministry who has preached here more than once. John used to speak a lot about a God-shaped blank in man's soul. And it's quite clear that this dear man knows about that. Look at these verses then, 3-9. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever turning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. That's exciting, isn't it? To the place the streams come from, there they return again. And children would say, well, could you explain that? And I think it needs some explanation, doesn't it? All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, or the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Now, what does that make you think of? Someone forever going round in circles and getting nowhere. It's a bit like a perpetually orbiting spaceship or satellite. A spaceship whose occupants long to break out of its orbit and go somewhere else and do and see something else, but they can't. Or it's like an eternal treadmill. Derek Kidner uses that word a number of times. The treadmill, the ass that treads out the corn in the Middle East, or tramps out the grapes. The ass might feel this, if it feels anything at all. But an intelligent man, the wisest mere man who ever lived, if it is he, how he must at some point have shut God out of his life. As many do. I, believers, try to do that. I've a letter from a young girlfriend of mine who writes poems. And it's clear that the lass, due to bereavements and other sorrows, and possibly also to the introspective cast of a poetic mind, has gone all pessimistic. Although she is, this is the strange thing to me, she is presently engaged in one of the most absorbingly creative artistic tasks you could wish for. And this is what she writes to me this past week. The storm, she's studying by the sea, and there was a storm in progress while she was writing. The storm raging outside reminds me of the storm within. It is difficult to be in the world and not of it. And when I reply to her, I'll say, not if you have the aid of the Holy Spirit, my dear. But that's what she says. Difficult to be in the world and not of it. However, she says, I suppose it was never meant to be easy. Sometimes I wonder whether I will make it through my life with my faith intact. A dear lass who's brought up in one of the most believing homes one could find. I wonder whether I will make it through my life with my faith intact. So I must write to her and say, my dear, you, I fear, have taken your eyes off your wonderful Lord. And all the shine has gone out of his world for you. You've become blind again. Blinded. Wouldn't you agree that that's what one should say to her gently and kindly? Of course. And you see, the more sensitive a nature to the glories and the beauties and the hidden treasures of the world, apparently, the easier it is to become bored with it all. So it would seem, when life loses, if I may change figures, when life loses its mainspring. Well, when life does lose its mainspring, it's virtually like a watch which has stopped going, isn't it? It may be the most expensive and most wonderful watch in the world, but if it's stopped, what's the use of it? It's a mere ornament to look at. Whereas when it is working, one sees all its beauty and revels in one's possession of such a rare piece of intricate mechanism. It may be, have many, many jewels within and without. But it would be some use if it would go. Otherwise, it's a mere ornament and useless. And to go on and say, for the writer to go on and say there is nothing new to be discovered under the sun. We feel like saying to the writer, you should live in our day. You should have seen wireless communication of one kind or another, and flying machines, and heart transplants, and nuclear fission, etc., etc., etc. Ah, but you may say, these things are not pristine new. They were all there, as the writer says, they were all there to be discovered. Yes, of course. And how many more, too, as yet undiscovered? But to say there is nothing new under the sun is simply, will you agree with this? Is simply the view of someone who has sought at some point in life to harness the whole earth, if not the universe, to his own personal sin-soaked and greedy life, and who has discarded as useless and therefore uninteresting anything which does not immediately pander to his own private needs and wants. Then he says something which, of course, the writer says something which has a certain amount of authentic truth, or it can have, that men come and go from generation to generation, and apart from whatever heritage of achievement they leave behind them, that is to remind future generations of them and their works, they simply go mouldering into the dust. And as far as this life under the sun is concerned, that's the end of them. Walk through a cemetery and read dead history. They're all gone. Many of them forgotten. That's true. But then that's a most astonishingly narrow view to take of life, isn't it? For one who believes in God, Even if, like my poet, young poetess friend, even if one has put one's faith in cold storage for a time, that's an astonishingly narrow view of life, isn't it? Why, what we ended with this morning answers that. Do you remember what we ended in the scriptures this morning with? These words, therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen under the sun, but on what is unseen, for what is seen is temporary. But what is unseen is eternal. And you remember, don't you, the answer to the question in the shorter catechism, what benefits do believers receive from Christ at death? And the answer? The souls of believers are at their death made perfect in holiness and do immediately pass into glory, and their bodies, being still united to Christ, do rest in their graves till the resurrection. There's nothing narrow about that. So, at verse 12 of our chapter, the Koheleth, the teacher, king over Jerusalem, proceeds to tell us how he came to the conclusions we are studying in these verses. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. That's an awful conclusion to come to, don't you think? How could he arrive at anything so silly? Well, the writer must have experienced that at some point, or he couldn't have written of it. But you may say, life is such a burden, isn't it? Well, yes, if you want to carry the world on your back, even your own little world on your back, when you, let alone your own little world, are not your own, that's daft, isn't it? When the world floats, and glides on nicely without you. And although we know it's a little off the plumb, and that was surely man's fault by the fall, the world hasn't got out of God's hand yet, has it? And still remains held firmly in place by its sun. And who holds that sun? Or any other sun in its place? Because this man is a king, and a great king at that, and appointed king by his own God, Jehovah, Yahweh, he seems to think, or has thought at some time in his life, and is challenging people about this, he seems to think he has an absent landlord deity who has left it all to him. And you see, for all Solomon's wonderful powers, you know, his wisdom and all that, God-given, don't forget Solomon, God-given, for all his wonderful powers, apparently he's not able to cope with life. And the task, even for him, becomes so overwhelming that he loses sight of any mere respectable manward goal and gets himself millions of miles away from his own limited God-given task on earth. And says as he whirls into the nothingness of empty space, all is vanity and chasing after wind. Of course, you can see how vaulting his mind becomes when he says in verse 15, what is twisted cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted? Of course not. It can't be straightened or counted by you, preacher. You can't sort out everything that is wrong with a fallen universe, you silly old king. But do you not believe that God, who made and controls all things, is waiting his time to sort it all out? And in the fullness of time, he will sort it all out. Listen to this. Now, faith is being sure of what we hoped for and certain of what we do not see. Hebrews 11 and 1. This is what the ancients were commended for. Faith that was sure of what it hoped for and certain of what it did not see. But Solomon surely forgot this. Was it in his old age? Do you think? Otherwise, how could such a fool of a son as Rehoboam have succeeded such a wise father on the throne? That's a mystery. If Solomon is the wisest mere man who ever lived, surely his son Rehoboam, who divided the kingdoms into 10 and 2, was one of the biggest fools in biblical history. So, it appears that the old man, if the writer is an old man, in his frustration, turned, look down towards the end of our chapter, turned from his pursuit of wisdom to that of folly, just for a break, apparently, and a diversion. Just as old people without Christ, and alas, some people with Christ but have become backsliders in their middle age and old age, just as such people often turn frivolous in their middle years and old age. It's shocking. And some people, entertainers and social workers in particular, love to stir old people up to a life of sheer frivolity, fun all the time, with no thought. And this is the burden of those who go to eventide homes of the gospel, with no thought at all that soon they'll be in their graves. And where will their souls be then? You see, and if the writer found the pursuit of wisdom dissatisfying, and increasingly sought carnal indulgences, as many old people do, what would he find in madness and folly? So he learns, at least, that wisdom is better than folly and madness. But, what had wisdom brought to him? Look at the last verse in our chapter. Much sorrow. And the more knowledge, this is very telling, the more knowledge, the more grief, alas. And that is true, I'm sure, of those without Christ, or who turn away from Christ. So, that's chapter 1. And you'll be maybe interested to know that that is all I felt I had to say about chapter 1. Although I could smother you with apt quotations from the commentaries, not least from George Phillips' one down there, entitled The Hard Life. I think I can see the influence of his literary wife. What have I done? That's right. How did I make that transition? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I've jumped across to 318. That's what I've done. I wondered. It wasn't making sense. 217, sorry. Bear with me. So I hated life. That wasn't tying up. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me.
All of it is meaningless, a chasing after wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Well, we know. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. I wonder if he'd had premonition about Rehoboam. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun, for a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. Now, that makes more sense to what I was saying than the other. Sorry that I took so long to see it. But you see, with regard to these verses, the nature of the mind that thinks like that is the nature of a mind that not only rules out God and the hereafter and the whole spiritual world, and they don't come into his reckoning, I mean in this passage, but even his fellow man who comes after him is not really in his thoughts at all in any serious way. This man portrayed here in these verses 17 to 23 is not only living in a world with the top lopped off, but also in a world in which he is the king and the head and the only potentate. And what does not satisfy him and bring him immediate pleasure and profit is absolutely out. He has no time for any other soul except as he or she panders to his satisfaction. And this passage, you see, shows not only a philosophy for of a thoroughly worldly man, a world with, I would say, the creative top blown off, but it is a philosophy which excludes consideration of any other creature, past, present, or future, who is not of instant use to him, to provide him with satisfaction. And he envies the one who will inherit what he has done and what he has made once he is gone. He has become, this poor rich man, he has become the only God there is, and nothing has any right to flow past him, but only into him. And that which does not tend toward him is out, is irrelevant, disallowed. And indeed, what isn't vitally related to him is to him actually obscene and outrageous. But a glimmer of light appears with verse 24. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. God now comes into his reckoning. Just a little. His fellow man doesn't come into his reckoning here, of course. That's too much to expect yet. But God is in. And with God, you see, the man begins to come down to real solid earth. The earth which God made and governs for our good. It's from the hand of God that we should not vault out of our orbit and become gods, or to try to become like gods. That was the serpent's temptation to Eve in the garden. Ye shall become like gods. And notice, it is he, our gracious providential God, who ordains that we should eat and drink and find satisfaction in our work. And we'll only find satisfaction in our work if we accept the limitations of our calling
and get on with our own job. You in your small corner and I in mine. And not you or me vaulting over every other creature and trying to be more than God meant you or me to be. And this is contentment. And we know what Paul said about that. Perhaps it's too early to bring in that giant of spiritual insight to slosh poor old Solomon too hard. But you know, I can't forbear to quote Philippians 4 and 10. I rejoice greatly in the Lord, he says, that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. No, it's not too early to bring that in, is it? Because the preacher now goes on to say that the true source of satisfaction is not in oneself, nor in any other person, nor in anything under the sun, but in God. And the only valid and laudable aim in life is to please him. We were speaking earlier about the utter selfishness of a man who wanted to be God and cause all things to tend to his pleasure and his satisfaction only. But now you see the preacher says it is God who desires that everything should please him, the Lord. When you read that about God who seeks above all things his own glory, Do you ever dare in the recesses of your mind to think this thought? Does this not mean that God is selfish and self-centered when he wants all to his glory and he disapproves of us seeking our glory? What do you think about that? And what would you say? What would you say in God's defense of such a claim that God is selfish and self-centered? I hope you would say something like this. Just that he is the only self-existent being in three persons. And he made things for his own pleasure and for that of his Son and Spirit. But although all else in the universe are his creatures, the pleasure he sought in them and from them was far from irrespective of their highest pleasure. You see, there's nothing selfish or self-centered in him at all. The very reverse, and the cross tells us that. He was willing to go to all possible lengths to care for others. It was love that created, for he loves with an everlasting love. And it was see the humility of it. It was for mutual good and benefit and profit to him and to us that he made us at all. It is not selfishness which wants to share its divinity as far as creatures can share divinity. We can't be God, we know that.
That's not selfish, to have a share with him. His glory, as verse 26 says, to the man who pleases God. We haven't read those verses. Let's look now. 24. We'll read. Yes, we've read 24. Let's read. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too, he says, is vanity, a chasing after wind. To the man who pleases God, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. And it is these gifts which give light and understanding to our meaning of life. For they are gifts handed on by a gracious deity who has demonstrated his love and his care for us, his children, by giving us nothing less than himself for our ransom and our relief and our salvation. Whereas the sinner who lives utterly for himself and is utterly disinterested in anyone else hoards like the man who tore down his barns to build greater, as if he was to live on earth forever. And then death suddenly overtook him. And as we were saying to the little ones the other Sunday, none of his hoard can he take with him. The old folks used to say, there are no pockets in a shroud. Not a thing can he take with him but a shriveled soul, all eaten up with sheer unadulterated materialism, as if under the sun was absolutely all there was, nothing beyond it. Now, what was that to bring before the King of the universe, his God, who himself pointed the way to life by dying that most awful death on the cross in order to slay that in turn self worshipping spirit that Satan has planted in the human breast? All the so-called wise man had built up, like the preacher says about the building projects he undertook in chapter 2, verses 4 to 6. Even if it was all left to those who came after, who might benefit from them, they would mean nothing to him if he had to go and leave it all. So you see how utterly selfish that spirit is. It's thinking only of itself, and it is utterly limited to this life. In fact, it seems to me that it's almost demonic, satanic, in its internness. Don't you think? Of course, to a man with an attitude to life like that, all is, in fact, vanity when he is separated from his toys. Toys that he has turned into gods. Of course, all is vanity. God gave Solomon rivers of gold and of silver and every other delight the eye could behold and enjoy, everything that a man could have on earth. But the Lord never meant Solomon or anyone succeeding him so to fix his eye on these things that God's face was blotted out from his own sight. He was to enjoy all these things as far as they were gifts of God to him, like his wisdom. He was to enjoy all these things before the Lord. That's what I'm going to say to the young poetess. She has
Maybe it would seem almost innocently forgotten the Lord and try to find satisfaction in the world without her Lord, her Savior. How terrible. Now, Paul says this in two places about living our lives before the Lord. In 1 Corinthians 10:31, he says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. And then to the Colossians 3:17, he says, and whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. All. But you may say, and I could say too, that's a large order. That's a large order. What it involves is nothing less than the whole of life. The whole of life on all levels and in all its various departments gathered together into one like a bundle of sticks. The demand is complete. But as you know, sticks don't appear ready-made in bundles, nor do they grow in bundles. They have to be gathered. And that's exactly what has to be done with the various strands of disintegrate human personalities which Satan sends sprawling and scatters. The strands have to be gathered and bound together into one. And the psalmist, you see, understood this when he cried, unite my heart to fear your name. That word unite. Unite my heart, the various strands of my personality, torn to pieces and scattered everywhere. Unite my heart to fear your name. And of course, fear there means not terror, but that holy reverence mingled with love, which draws a man in his totality into what I call here a personality uniting activity of worship and devotion. You see, if we're really doing our stuff properly today in God's house, we are doing something to integrate our personalities and make us happy tomorrow. And we haven't been worshipping aright if it doesn't. And so, by devoting ourselves, laying all on the altar, gathering the bundle of sticks and letting him bind them together into one, until all our component parts find their true place and function, then we know peace and happiness. Now I wondered in closing how I could make this total submission to the Lord vivid and arresting. For the whole idea of totally yielding ourselves to the Lord is so pervasive, isn't it? That it must affect the whole of our lives at all times and in all places and in all circumstances. And you see, it's a matter of entrusting one's total life to the Lord. Well, after all, there's nothing about this world that he created that he cannot know about. He knows everything. He knows all about the discoveries that are yet to be made by science. Discoveries that will yet stagger the world. Long before they are dreamed of, he knows them all. He made them all. And so thinking about how I could make this vivid and arresting, it suddenly struck me that the Bible has a word for it. As simple as anything you could imagine. So I looked up a certain formula of words in the Bible Concordance, and I began to count how often it appeared in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, until I got tired. There were over 200 references, and I wanted to go on and look on at the references to this formula of words in the historical books and the Psalms. I would have wanted to trace it into the New Testament. But there were far too many pages in Strong's Concordance. What was the formula? It was before the Lord. And you read these three words in all these books, in every conceivable situation, grave and gay, good and bad, before the Lord, before the Lord, before the Lord,
pages. Israel practically did everything before the Lord. And when she did, all went well. The trouble is, of course, Satan has so disaffected us towards God and Jesus. We wouldn't say that. We don't say that in our prayers. But we feel it, and sometimes we even think it. Satan has so disaffected us toward God. We have a wrong sort of fear of him and dread of him and withdraw from him. We often charge him with being the source of our unhappiness, do we not? Satan has done all that, that even at best we are suspicious of our God and even suspicious sometimes of Jesus. We think, we will not believe the sheer, pure love that the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit have for us. We don't believe it. We don't believe it. If we believed it, we would bathe in it, and we'd be so different. We think that sin will put them off, whereas they are able to deal with all sin and put it away, so that we may enjoy the sweetest fellowship possible. Now, when will we see that and learn to live our lives before the Lord? Well, you see, this is happiness. This is joy. This is satisfaction and glory and every other delight besides. To live the whole of our lives in company with him, and whatever excitement there will be down here, there will certainly not be boredom. We may get tired, of course, and even exhausted, and need rest. And rest is often the most painful thing to initiate, isn't it? Some people want rest. But even then, with him, with Jesus in the vessel, the most trying and testing storm are more than tolerable. So we simply need to take to task this wisest man, if he is in fact the wisest man who ever lived, and say to him, look here, Solomon, old boy, get back before the Lord. Foolish old fellow, back before the Lord. And like the rich young ruler was told to do, sell all, and you will have life indeed and eternal. But of course we know that Solomon knew that. There were two lines running through my mind as I concluded the notes on this meditation, and I found them in the Salvation Army songbook, and then I wanted to find them somewhere else because I wanted to know the author. And I tried 7 or 8 different hymn books and didn't find it in any one. Then my sister helped me, and we found that it was a hymn by Albert Midlane, M-I-D-L-A-N-E, 1825 to 1909. Now, whether he's American or British or whatever, I don't know. But he is also the author, as you would see in the hymnary, of Revive Thy Work, O Lord, and There's a Friend for Little Children. There's also a wonderful hymn in the Welsh hymn book that begins, Himself He Cannot Save, and that's a moving hymn. If there were time, I would be glad to read it to you. But only in this Salvation Army hymn book can I find this hymn. It's perhaps not all the best of verse, and it's really a gospel hymn. Let me run through it quickly and come to the two lines that run in my mind. I've heard salvationists singing this in the open air in many, many streets in Aberdeen, east and west. I'll give you the two lines first. Life is found alone in Jesus, only there 'tis offered thee. Does that ring a bell with any of you? Life is found alone in Jesus, only there 'tis offered thee. Offered without price or money, 'tis the gift of God sent free. Take salvation, take it now, and happy be. And each verse ends like that. Here's the beginning. Hark the voice of Jesus calling, come ye guilty, come to me. I have rest and peace to offer. Rest thou laboring one for thee. Take salvation, take it now, and happy be. Yes, though high in heavenly glory, still the Savior calls to thee. Faith can hear his invitation, come ye laden, come to me. Take salvation, take it now, and happy be. Soon that voice will cease its calling. Now it speaks and speaks to thee. Sinner, heed the gracious message. To the blood for refuge flee. Take salvation. Take it now, and happy be. Life is found alone in Jesus. Only there 'tis offered thee. Offered without price or money. 'Tis the gift of God sent free. Take salvation. Take it now. All the Solomons of the world, and happy be. Now let's sing